The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about what the Church is doing in the world, and we talk with those people who try to make our world more just, more compassionate. And we call it Just Love because we think if you just do it, if you just love God, if you just love yourself, if you just love your neighbor, then our world will be more just and more compassionate. And what a better way to start that than the new year, because we get a fresh start at trying to make the world more just and more compassionate. So we're delighted that we're going to be doing that. And I hope that everybody had wonderful Christmas and wonderful New Year's. Those of us here in the Northeast in New York, we got a little bit of a surprise because it was like July and December. So it wasn't cold enough. And I got to tell you, you know, Brooke, I don't know about you, but I think I had a little problem because there was no snow. So I don't think Santa got to me with all my presents. How about you? Did Santa get to you?
Oh, no. Well, yeah, Santa definitely got to me.
Yeah?
I was clearly his favorite. No. Yeah.
So fess up. So what'd you get? What'd you get as Christmas?
I got a lot of cool things.
Okay.
I got Bluetooth speakers.
Ooh.
Yeah. They work great.
Okay.
I tried them on and was singing around my house. My family wanted to kill me.
Oh, well. Okay. I'm glad they didn't. We would have missed you. Okay.
And I got Bluetooth speakers, which I was blasting around the house.
Right. So you got two sets of Bluetooth speakers?
One was headphones.
Oh.
One was speakers.
Wow. Okay.
And let's see what else. I got some clothes and some jewelry.
Good. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Now, Tom, you know what I think happened? I think... Because there wasn't much snow, Santa had a time, and his sled got stuck at Brooke's house, and he dropped off my gifts at Brooke's because I didn't get Santa. I don't think Santa made it to my place for Christmas, but you know what? But Jesus did.
Oh,
and I love Santa. Okay, Santa's great. Okay, and I love Jesus. But I guess if I got to choose, I hope Jesus shows up because, you know, but I want them both, okay? I don't want Santa to feel, you know, that I'm against him. I like Santa, but Jesus showed up, and that's pretty good too.
Yeah, that's probably better.
Yeah, it is better. It is better. We could have both. Anyway, so that's what we're about. So today, you know, we're going to talk about the New Year's, and the first guest that we have is Dr. Nina Radcliffe, who is a practicing physician in New Jersey. She is an anesthesiologist. And I promised Dr. Radcliffe that I wouldn't make any sleepy jokes about anesthesiologists before we got on the air. So, but maybe on the air I might make a few. But anyway, but Dr. Radcliffe, thank you so much for being with us and joining us on Just Love.
Thank you, Monsignor Sullivan. It's an honor.
Well, I'm delighted that you are here. And so let our listeners know a little bit, you know, where'd you kind of begin life and how'd you wind up being an anesthesiologist? Just give us the thumbnail sketch.
Yeah, I grew up in California.
Yay!
I've been practicing for about 13 years.
Well, when are you going to get it right?
When am I going to get it right?
You're still practicing?
I am still practicing.
Oh, well, I mean, don't we want a doctor who gets it right?
Not
one
who do.
But you're still practicing?
I'm still trying to figure it out.
Well, you know, that's what they talk about. They talk about practicing Catholics. I think we should get it right, don't we? I mean, you know, we should
commit.
Yeah, we should get it. But, you know, but I got to tell you a little secret, Dr. Radcliffe. Here's my secret. My secret is I think there are only three places that somebody should live in the world, okay? New York and California and Paris. Those are the only three places that people should live. So you come from one of those great places in the world, in California.
And I'm in New York right now.
Yay! That is good. That is good. So you grew up in California. And so how'd you kind of wind up being a practicing anesthesiologist?
Well, my mom is a practicing physician as well, too. So I had a wonderful role model. And I've always been a communicator and loving being able to teach people and talk to people about their health. And I used to be at the University of Pennsylvania as a faculty member there. And life events, marriage, as well as a child brought me to New Jersey.
Great. Great. And was your mom also an anesthesiologist?
No, she couldn't spell that. She was a family practice.
Okay. So she wasn't a sleepy doctor.
No, she was not.
A sleepy doctor. So, but you have I know you do a lot of kind of communicating about health. You communicate about wellness. And since we're beginning the new year now, it's a time when I think a lot of people kind of think about what they're going to do more for their health in the new year, and they make some resolutions about the new year. You've kind of written a little bit about resolutions, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
So tell us about these new year resolutions. Tom, did you make any?
You know, Monsignor, I did not make any this year.
All right. No New Year's resolutions. All right. So tell us about them, Nina.
Well, you know, I think that it's just a time of hope and reflection where we can look back to see where we can become better. And most of the time people make resolutions that involve their health. But I think it's more about your just body and soul as well as your health and overall improvement, things we can do.
Okay. So does anybody keep them?
That's an interesting question. 25% of resolutions are dropped within the first week. So we're almost at that point where a quarter of them have been dropped. And they say about 8% keep them throughout the year.
Huh. So do you have any recommendations to people? Is it a good idea that people make them?
I think it's absolutely. We always want to become better. And these are things that sometimes may not happen this year, but may occur next year. And it's always a great opportunity to reflect, look, and plan. And I think that's the key. A goal without a plan is just a wish, and we can never get there. It's like trying to find a location, a destination, but without a map. You may get lucky. You might be like Christopher Columbus and find America, or you may just never find anything.
He had a plan, though.
He did have a plan.
His plan was to find the West Indies, the Indies, right?
And he didn't get there.
Didn't get there. but, okay, a little bit of trivia, though, which is why what they call his company that he sailed under.
Well, one of his ships was called the Nina.
Yeah.
And that's so, what my dad named me after.
After the ship?
Yes.
Really?
Yep. My dad was so excited to be in the United States that he read and loved Christopher Columbus, and he named me Nina.
Wow. That's intriguing. But the name of his company was the West Indies Trading Company.
Nice.
That's what he did. So you're named after the Christopher Columbus, after the Nina.
I'm glad I'm not the Pinta.
No, you wouldn't like that?
No, I wouldn't have liked that.
How about the Santa Maria?
I could have done Santa Maria.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good. So, do you have any advice to people about what they might do in order to better keep their resolutions?
Well, the goal is to have a plan. When you make a commitment to being better, you have to give the amount of time, you have to give the right effort. It's wonderful to say, I want to lose some weight, but that usually involves eating better. It usually involves increasing your activity, but you have to a lot for that. If not, it's like I said, it's just a wish. So once again, if you make a decision, I want to quit smoking, it's not going to just happen by snapping your fingers. It may, but the likelihood is it won't. So there's different ways to go about that. You can find a social group. You can write it down. You can talk to your physician. There's a number of different ways to make these plans, and I think that's key.
So do you find in resolutions that it helps to kind of have a group, or is it better to go it alone, or does it matter on the type of resolution that it is?
I think it depends upon the resolution.
Okay. So let's say the stopping smoking. Is that one that works better with a group?
That depends upon the individual. First of all, once you make a decision, that's part of the battle. Knowing that you need to quit smoking because it can improve your life, your way you breathe, decrease your risk of heart disease, you can be around loved ones longer, that's important. And once you do, there's different ways for different people. I know people who've quit smoking cold turkey. My father was one of them. When they told him it was bad, he started smoking before anyone knew it was bad, while the cigarette companies were saying it's not that bad, it's okay, and they were hiding all the studies. But the day he found out and his doctor said, you need to stop smoking, it's bad for your health, he stopped cold turkey. But I know people who've done different methods. They've required patches or certain types of gum. They've required hypnotherapy. And some people are using these electronic cigarettes to try to bridge it. But we do know that cigarettes are an addiction, and there has to be a way to try to cut that addiction.
So when we think about resolutions, and you've mentioned two, losing weight, and you've mentioned cigarette smoking, but you know, from our perspective, when we think about the human person, we think about the person holistically. And we think that a person isn't merely physical health, but we also talk about emotional health. And if we talked about even spiritual health, so that when we look at it, what are some of the resolutions that you've come across over the years that have to do with, let's say, emotional health?
Right. Well, I'm a strong believer that they're all interconnected and all interrelated. Emotional health is so important as well as mental, and they usually go hand in hand, and that's where many people will draw upon spiritual to help them get through that. When you have a good spiritual base, it really can get you through a number of different things that we deal with in life, such as stress, depression, anxiety, along with all using medical care.
And so can you think of in your writing, your research, what are some of the kind of emotional or psychological resolutions that people tend to make?
A lot of people, one of the top Googled questions was, how do I decrease stress around the New Year's time? Stress is a killer. It's a silent killer. And some people say it contributes to 60% of physical ailments. And I've even read that it contributes to 90%. All I know is it's a lot of people, more than half, stress can contribute to some other type of chronic illness.
And so let me ask you, suppose we just kind of knock them out.
I think
with
that's
anesthesia.
A wonderful idea. Yeah.
That would reduce the stress, right?
Yes, an independent reason to get anesthesia, not just for surgery.
I like it. So we got one way we can do it, but there might be other ways, right?
Yeah, there's a number of different ways. And, you know, stress is, there's some people who say there is no such thing as stress because that's their perception. But there are two aspects. Stress was a response that our body was given by Mother Nature. God gave it to us when we were running from dinosaurs or other predators. When we perceived a stress or a danger.
I might be old enough to have run from dinosaurs, but you certainly are not.
No. But, you know, it's a perception of a danger, something that is disturbing. And then it gives our body an increase in blood pressure, an increase in heart rate, an ability to flee or fight predators. And essentially, that's the way it was built. But now, in today's day and age, we're seeing stress with finances. We're seeing stress with children. We're seeing stress with relationships. And just the state of the world today, all the bombings and the terrorism, that's stressful. But it's also a way that we perceive it. So there's the perception as well as the way our body acts, which is an automatic response.
You know, Nina, one of the things, though, it seems to me that people talk about being stressed. They talk about being depressed, or they talk about certain things. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, just don't worry about it. Which seems to me, oftentimes when you say that, people almost tend to worry more about it.
Right. And I think you need to appreciate the response. And people try to minimize it, but that in and of itself can be stressful. You say, don't worry about it, but I'm still worrying about, is it something wrong with me? But I have to say, everyone encounters stress. It's the trash of modern life. It piles up, and if you don't get rid of it, it can take over.
We're speaking with Dr. Nina Radcliffe, who is a practicing physician, and after doing it for a while, she's pretty good at it.
And still practicing.
She's still practicing, but she's pretty good at it. And she is at the Atlantic Care Regional Medical Center in South Jersey. And we're talking a little bit about New Year resolutions. We're talking about how one kind of sets goals and then sets a plan to move forward on those goals. And we've kind of gotten to the point where we're talking a little bit more than physical health. We're talking a little bit about emotional health. But, you know, so let's get a little practical. So somebody says, you know, I really am feeling too stressed. My body is too stressed. I'm going to resolve to feel less stressed. So that's my goal. So what kind of plan might I make to do that?
I think it's important to understand what your triggers are in the first place. What is stressing you out? Is it a relationship? Is it, some people are empathic stressors, meaning if their loved one is stressed, they automatically have a stress response to it, which is very amazing because it shows a compassion. There's also a fear of missing out, which social media has done a lot of. Are we extending all of our abilities to enjoy and pursue different options? There's just a number of different stressors. It's important to understand, is it work? Is it finances? And once you identify it, you can learn different ways. Do you want to be able to avoid it? It's hard to avoid a spouse or a child, but then can you adapt to it? Can you alter the way that you deal with it? Or do you just accept it and there's different ways. And once you determine that, then there's also other outlets to deal with stress. I love the one of exercise. It's one of those things you can raise your endorphins, which are our body's natural painkiller. And then there's always meditation. There's prayer. And it took me having to be so devastated in some personal aspects of my life and be on my knees that the only way I can get back up was through prayer, because I was already on my knees. So
that's a very interesting interesting idea. And I do think sometimes I heard somebody who was a chaplain in the Army say to me that the hardest exercise in the whole world is tying your shoes to get to the gym, to do the exercise. Once you put on your boots, once you put on your sneakers, you've already kind of made the commitment and you're far more than halfway there. And I, you know, when he told me that, I said, I think there's something to that.
I do. Once you made a decision that you want to do it, and once you start the roll, it's like a snowball effect. You can get there a little bit faster. And once you're halfway there and you've already done it, it's a positive feedback.
Yeah. And it is, and I'll just share with you, you know, my own experience is that I don't really hate to exercise. I kind of like it, but it's work sometimes to do it. But I do know that kind of when I do it, then I feel much better for the rest of the day.
Right.
But it's that initial thing of doing it or not doing it that makes it very, you know, very difficult to to do. So it's important, as you say, you have a goal, but you also have to have a plan to get through that goal.
Right.
So we talked a little bit about some of the emotional stuff, we began to move into the spiritual stuff. Are there any kind of spiritual resolutions that people kind of tend to make that kind of they like to try to begin again in the new year?
Well, I think a sense of gratitude is something very important. I start talking about this around Thanksgiving because it's the one day of the year that we dedicate to giving thanks, but I think it's something that we need to use the 364 other days of the year. And I wake up with the spirit of gratitude to God, of course, in the first thing in the morning. And I recommend that many people keep a journal to look at the positives that they have in life instead of focusing on the negatives. It can elevate our mood. It can make us less depressed, less anxious. There's a lot of positive effects about being grateful for what you have.
You know, it's very interesting. There's somebody who I've known for many years who is an incredibly wonderful person and certainly a far better person than I am. But his approach to life oftentimes is he gets very anxious and he gets very upset when things go wrong or when people don't act the way that they are supposed to act. And it really kind of upsets him when they don't do that. And I think one of the reasons is because he is such a good person and he acts so wonderfully most of the time that it upsets him that other people don't. And the conversation that we usually have with him is, I said, I think the world divides into two types of people. And the people who are very, very comfortable with sin. And I think the world is kind of filled with sin and things being wrong. And okay, that's the world that we live in. And there are these wonderful moments of grace in which we're really, really happy about it. Then there are other people who I think, like my friend, who really is in favor of grace and is so upset by the sin, by the failings that are there. And boy, you're going to get very upset if you're looking for everything to be filled with what's right in the world. And I think, you know, some people, I just notice people, maybe it's another version of the glass. Is the glass half filled or is it half empty?
Well, I think it's expectations, too. When you have expectations of others, you only set yourself up for disappointment. But I think a state of love or good is something independently you can do. That's your state. It doesn't matter if 5 years down the road, that particular person doesn't love you back, has wronged you or something. You still can live with this state of love and the energy that you exude, because that's you independently. So,
you know what I think you pointed out, and we're speaking with Dr. Nina Radcliffe, who is a physician in Jersey, an anesthesiologist, and we're talking about how one kind of looks at health in a way that you really can move forward and improve your life, not merely physical, emotional, but also spiritual. It seems to me, though, kind of one of the big challenges we face is that the world is complex, that the world is not simple. So in other words, let's just share our conversation. We basically talked about how if you're going to set a resolution, if you're going to have a plan, then you need a plan. Then you need to have a plan to get to the resolution. Now, you've now set an expectation. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't fulfill the expectation, there's going to be some amount of disappointment. On the other hand, if you go through life with ever setting a resolution, with ever having a plan, then you're not going to be happy either. So I think you've created this incredible world where we don't know what to do. So tell us, solve it for us, Dr. Radcliffe.
Well, expectations of ourselves can be resolutions without expecting another person's outside to to what that is. We can make plans for ourselves to always better ourselves, whether it is eating better, whether it is quitting drinking too much or smoking. There's always things we can do. And that expectation of ourselves is to make us a better person.
I'll share with our listeners that why Dr. Radcliffe chose to point out drinking too much. Just so you know, we're kind of taping in a new studio this week. And this studio is filled with tequila. It's filled with other types of liquor that's here.
So half-empty bottles.
Half-empty, which I point out were half-empty before we got here.
Yes, Monsignor.
So it's not us who are doing it. So I think that's why she's pointing out this as as something that we should be concerned about. So, you know, it's interesting is that oftentimes, like we talk about the New Year's, New Year resolutions. But in our Christian tradition, we also talk about Lent as being a time in which there are a new beginning, in which we try to convert, which we try to reform our lives. And to some extent, I think they are really parallels to New Year's resolutions, where we kind of commit ourselves to certain things and then make plan to do them. And here we say for 40 days. And I think that's a pretty good parallel from a kind of a spiritual Christian perspective, what the secular world does in trying to kind of move in the right path. You know, again, from your experience, are resolutions becoming more prevalent, less prevalent? What's going on kind of in the general population about them?
I think it depends upon the person. A lot of people get frustrated. They may have said last year, the year before, that they want to lose weight and they didn't quite meet their goals. And it's interesting, there were some recent Gallup polls, not to bore you with the details of it, but they're saying that people are more happy with their current weight, even though obesity is rising, and they're less likely to do something serious about that. And that might be because they've been frustrated or they haven't quite achieved their goals in the past. And to that, I say, continue on. It's always important to try to become better. And many times it takes 5 to 10 years to really achieve that goal that you put forth. But just because it doesn't happen 1 year doesn't mean you have to give it up when there's an option, and to maybe try a different way about it.
Okay. One of the areas they tell me that obviously there's a great deal of change going on in the world in terms of publishing and books, and whether they be online books or whether they be serial books, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm told that the area that is incredibly growing by leaps and bounds are self-help books.
Yes.
And that to some extent, isn't a self-help book kind of a menu of resolutions?
It could be. And that's what's interesting. They were saying back in 2000, there's only like 50 books on how to be more happy. But now there's over 2,000-4,000 books that are being published about happiness. And so I think we're getting a better idea that there are other things that are important. Our happiness is important. Mindfulness is important. Meditation. There's so many different things that we're learning more about. We're trying to fit it in with our secular world, with our non-secular world. How does it mesh in today's day and age?
And do you think it's actually working? I mean, people doing these things to help themselves?
I think they're realizing it's happening. I don't know how effective they are. I don't feel necessarily that we are going down the right path in some aspects of this. The concept of needing to be happy all the time. What does happiness mean? I think the way that we define this, anytime somebody has had a breakup or they feel sad for a little bit, they may jump on medications, and that might not necessarily be the answer. It's also, we become a nation that's used to taking pills to solve all of our problems. So I think it depends upon what we're talking about, if we're going down the right track with it. I know with technology we're doing a great job, but does it mean necessarily we're happier people or better people because of the things we're doing?
Well, and as you said, it probably, there's a variety of things that make different people happy.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's, I guess one of the things that I worry about in terms of, let's say, this growth of self-help books or growth of books about happiness, and I worry about the internet and news and information, because a lot of it is unvetted.
Yes.
You know, there's you're not sure if it's quackery,
right,
or if it is genuine and it's just all out there, and it doesn't seem to some extent, I think that is a cause of stress. I'll say it's a cause of stress to me, because if you're looking something up, well, how do you know what you're looking up is really the solid stuff as opposed to, you know, just something that's out there?
So I think it's wonderful to have information at our fingertips, but as you said, we don't know how real it is. I think that there is a process. When we used to go to the library and look for something and then go over to the shelves and find it, it allows us the time to digest it, to process it, and to think about it. And I do think our minds were not meant to sit there and move at light speed in that sense. And I agree with you. I'm worried about our children. They have everything in our fingertips. They sometimes don't know what the difference is between reality and what's fact. It's difficult to know.
And I also think that sometimes, you know, we used to say the expression, is it in black and white, which is, mm-hmm, somebody once told me really used meant black on white, but anyway, was it written? And I think, I mean, I've heard a number of people tell me, like, oh yeah, well, I found it on the computer. Well, so, but that is if, like, that solves the problem, that,
right,
you know, or they say, oh well, I got this off the computer. Well, okay, thank you. So what? I mean, I think the availability of information sometimes hinders us from evaluating the information and how useful it is or how relevant it is to what I need to do with my life.
I agree completely.
And so to some extent, the increased information is one of those causes of stress in our lives.
I agree. It's like having a constant overload of information being thrown at you. How do we do it? It's just like when we're driving. We weren't meant to move at 75 miles per hour. We're not cheetahs. So all of a sudden, we're having all this information thrown at us without slowing down and allowing it to be absorbed. How does that work with our brain? Does that make us more likely to be anxious or depressed or stressed? We just don't know. This is a generation that we're going to start seeing these effects.
My question is, and it's almost a self question, is why does everybody blame kind of mobile devices and stuff for the incredible amount of stress? Because as far as I can tell, I haven't met any mobile device on the market that didn't have an off switch. You can turn them off, but I'm not sure I can, but I mean, but there's an off switch, and like, it's, we almost seem to have built up the expectation that if I'm not in contact every single moment of the day and night, well, I'm less a human being, or I'm not in the world, or the world is passing me by.
Well, Monsignor Sullivan, I think you bring up a good point. I've actually had that happen where people have texted me and I didn't get back immediately because,
right,
I'm actually working and taking care of patients.
Right.
They think I'm dead. They think something happened to me because I'm not getting back to them right away. We're not used to moving in light speed in that sense. And you bring up a good point also, is that it's important to, technology is great. It's helped us. There's no question about it. But how do we balance it with life and peace of our mind? And you're right, it does have an off switch. And in my household, everything has to go off an hour before bedtime so I can be at peace. Those bright screens are not good for us in terms of they suppress melatonin levels. And we'll get a little scientific here. It makes us not sleep as well. Melatonin is our sleepy hormone, and light, whether it's artificial light from televisions or laptops or it's the sunlight, can sit there and make us more awake.
Really?
Yes. Really?
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought the only thing I knew, which I felt I was smart about, I learned what's that thing that's in turkeys that puts me to sleep.
Tryptophan.
Yeah, that's the thing that I. So maybe if you have those on, you should eat turkey.
So eat turkey while you're texting somebody.
Yeah, and then it'll kind of
counteract. Then it'll balance each other.
Yeah, balance out.
We'll do a randomized controlled study on
that. Oh, okay. I'd like that.
Because I want to vet the information that you're giving me at this moment.
I want the turkey part because I love turkey. So it's great. So, hey, listen, I've taken so much of your time, and I am just absolutely delighted. Are there any specific things you're working on these days that you'd like to share with our listeners before I let you go?
Well, for this month, I do a weekly column that's syndicated through the country. I'm talking about stress, surprise causes of stress, how to deal with stress. And then starting February, we have American Heart Month, okay, where, because heart disease is the number one killer of both men and women, we have a special time committed to women, because many women do not know their symptoms for heart disease, which can be different than the chest pain that men typically see. And as a result, more women die from heart disease than men do because they do not get to the doctors or the hospital on time for that. So I'm doing a whole month dedicated to heart health.
Okay. Well, that's great. That's great. I think that heart thing, I heard something like women do tend to die more, but
they do.
But men have more heart attacks, but they tend to recover.
Absolutely. Well, part of the reason is because men have the Hollywood heart attack where there's chest pain that feels like an elephant sitting on your chest, and they are more likely to call 911, or somebody next to them is more likely to call 911. Women, on the other hand, are more likely to have maybe nausea, feelings of indigestion, maybe some pain in their jaw or their shoulder. And they seem to tend to put it off because they don't want to mess up the family's plans, or they don't want to look like they're overreacting.
Right.
And so we've had a complete shift in the way healthcare professionals think about this and are able to detect it. And we're pushing for women to start recognizing their symptoms, and as well as to know what their risk factors are. That we are, the American Heart Association is even encouraging women to go to your doctor just to talk about your heart health, so you can see what you can do to decrease your risk, because 80% of heart disease can be prevented by lifestyle changes. So the choices you make.
So that's one of the resolutions we could make. Where can people read your column?
Well, you can definitely Google me, or you can follow me on Facebook or Twitter.
Okay. Dr. Nina Radcliffe, who is a practicing anesthesiologist at Atlantic Care Regional Medical Center in South Jersey. Thank you so much for being with us on Just Love. I'm delighted, and our listeners learned a lot. So thanks for being with us, Dr.
It's my privilege. Thank you.
You know what? We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll figure out a little bit of news, and then we'll go to our next guest. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a minute or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. And we spoke about resolutions with Dr. Nina Radcliffe. And in a little bit, we're going to talk with Anton Sneinhardt, who is the founder and president of Wines for Humanity. And we're going to talk about what he's been doing to kind of give back in using wines as a way to raise some money for some charitable causes. Tom, give us just a couple of news items.
Sure, Monsignor. Well, one of the things I think, you know, we just passed through a new year, and there's some good news to report, obviously. One of the things is last year, the Death Penalty Information Center had just announced that the number of executions in the United States was at an all-time low. There were 28 recorded executions in the U.S. in 2015, which is 7 fewer than 2014, and it's the fewest number of executions since 1991, when there was only 14.
How many?
Last year there were 28.
Okay.
And now it turns out they were only carried out in 6 states, but some additional good news in that regard, too. Pennsylvania's governor announced there was going to be a moratorium on executions in 2015. The Connecticut Supreme Court called the death penalty unconstitutional, and the Nebraska legislature actually voted to repeal the state death penalty law. So some legislatures are busy working, Monsignor. So,
okay. So, anything else that's new?
Yes. One of the things that happened this week was President Obama also announced this week that he was going to be taking executive action to expand on background checks for some firearm purchases, as well as stepping up what he called federal enforcement of the nation's gun laws. He basically is going to clarify the existing gun laws by making sure that those who make a living by selling guns register as licensed gun dealers. In a sense, this is going to close a loophole that sometimes online gun merchants use in order to be able to sell guns. And they're also going to hire more people in the federal government. The FBI is going to put on 230 more people to process background checks in order to be able to be sure the people who have, you know, maybe who shouldn't have a gun, like, for example, if they have some mental health issues and such, would not be able to buy a gun online. So the president basically said he was going to do this because he basically said Congress was not acting. And he's and in his words, he says maybe the gun lobby can hold Congress hostage, but we cannot hold the American public hostage. We can't accept carnage in our communities. That's
okay.
Why he was.
What else do you have?
And then one thing is we have, of course, some the Pope Francis news, Monsignor. One thing that wound up coming up was Pope Francis, as it turns out, Gallup. I know Dr. Nina mentioned a Gallup poll before. Gallup did a poll before the end of the year this year. As it turns out, it was about popularity. The most popular man in the United States this past year has been President Obama, and he basically was voted the most popular among 13% of the American public. And believe it or not, this is kind of surprising, the second most popular people in the United States were both Pope Francis and Donald Trump.
You know, Tom, I think this is a good opportunity to kind of share something with our listeners. I'll just flat out and say it. I don't know the source of that information. I just think it's not worth the paper it's printed on. Mm. Because I think as we all know from a sophisticated point of view, if you look at polls, you have to know how the question is asked, you have to know what the size of the sample is, etc., and you have to know what's being asked. So when somebody says at the same time that the president is the most popular person in the world and his approval rating is so low, something's going on that's not telling you much useful information. I'm not saying making a point as whether President Obama is popular, unpopular, favorable, unfavorable view. All I'm telling you is that some of the information that's out there, we need to be far more discerning about how we evaluate that, especially if we're using that to make our decisions about what should be done, what we should act. And the other point to this is, which we say all the time, is that, you know, some of our moral values, some of our perspective on how the world should be operating, what we think is just and what we think would create a better society, is not based merely on a poll. It's not based upon what a majority of the people think. Now, that's different from saying that what people say don't matter. What people say does, that matters a whole lot. And one of our values in our Catholic social teaching is participation. We believe that people should participate in democracy. We believe that the people's opinions matter. But it is not purely what some media outlet reports in a poll. And even if the poll were accurate, it's not simply what a certain group of people feel at a particular time. It needs to be taken into consideration. But there's far more to figuring out how our world should be structured and what we should do to do that. So I'll get off my soapbox on picking on polls for a while. We'll take a break and we'll be back to talk about wine. Wine, not with an H, but wine as in red and white, but not whining. Anyway, this is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in a couple of minutes on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. We're going to speak now with Anton Steinhardt, who is the founder and the president of Wines for Humanity, which is basically an organization that raises money to help homeless projects and help people to stay in their homes through donating a portion of the revenues that is generated by the sales of wine. So let me welcome Anton Steinhardt, president and founder of Wines for Humanity, to our show. Welcome, Anton. Okay. We'll get to Anton in a minute, but this is a very good and interesting point of perspective, in the sense that a lot of people try to do some good with what they're doing, and we're delighted that, you know, Anton is doing that, and that he is giving back to society, and that's a very, very important important thing to do. And, you know, if people can have fun doing it, it's also very valuable. There are a lot of different ways that that happens. So let's talk with Anton now. Anton, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi there. How are you?
I am great. Thanks for joining us. So tell us a little bit about Wines for Humanity. Tell me how you started it and what's it all about.
Oh, my God. How much time do we have? Anyway, well, Wines for Humanity, what we do is we raise funds for the prevention of homelessness for families with children by doing in-home wine tastings with people that like wine. And then we donate from the top between 9 to 12.5% to charities, local charities that help people that are behind in rent and utilities. So that's where the prevention part comes in.
Wow, that is really good. So basically, it's a business, and there's some money made in these in-home wine parties, and then some of it is goes to organizations to prevent homelessness.
That's exactly it. You know, unlike many good companies that give from their profit, we give from the top. You know, whether we make money or not, the charities will always get the money.
Well, so tell us a little bit. How do those in-home wine tastings work? Give our listeners a little bit of sense.
Oh yeah. Okay. Wow. That is truthfully a wonderful experience. Imagine 14, 16 people coming together. It's friends, family. You know, we all social people like to get together from time to time. We bring 6, 7 wines. We introduce them on their merits, but embedded in there are anecdotes, stories, quizzes, so it's interactive. People have a ball. And, you know, this whole thing for 7 bottles is $59 plus tax, so there is nothing like it anywhere. So the host gets a heck of a deal. The people get free entertainment. And the charity raises money to help them to take care of people's needs.
The people who go, the 14 to 16 people, if they like the wines, they can order the wines at the event, right?
Yeah, they make a selection, and a week or two later, you know, we have a licensed premises, I should say, in 9 different states. We deliver the wine to them, and it all comes to a good end.
That is a wonderful, wonderful idea. Now, I'm familiar with a couple of other versions of using wine to raise money. The simplest one is, you know, an event that we have annually here at Catholic Charities in New York, in which at a golf outing, there are some nice bottles of wine that are there, and people are encouraged to buy them, and obviously the price that they pay is more than, you know, what they would pay on the shelf, but they're doing it for a charity, and that raises, you know, some money that we can use for our various charitable programs. The other type of event that I'm familiar with are wine auctions, in which I've been at events in which, you know, there have been some very, very fine wines that have been available for auction. They've been, you know, separated into different lots, and people bid on them, and that has generated a fair amount of money for various charitable purposes. So what you're telling me, I love what you're talking about, because it's another way that that people can kind of have a good time, enjoy wine, and still be doing something charitable.
Absolutely. And every year we got a unique mission within our vision, because our vision is to raise enough funds by doing these wine tastings that one day nobody in America should ever become homeless for reasons beyond their control. So last year, our goal was to raise enough funds for 1 million meals. And the little slogan we had was, every cork fills a fork. So
I like that.
Yeah. One thing, actually, thanks for bringing it up. I need to add something else about how to raise funds. What we also do is, let's say another organization not involved with homelessness, let's say leukemia, for example, is having a fundraiser, a golf outing, as you called it. We will donate to their Life or Silent Auction an in-home wine tasting that will go on the bidding table, and all the money that the people will bid on will go to that charity, and then we do the wine tasting with the winning bidder.
That's another way to kind of extend the good that you are doing. Did you reach the goal of 1 million meals?
Yeah, 1,025,000, as a matter of fact.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and that was in how much do you kind of estimate it costs for a meal?
Well, you know, when we give it to the food pantry, it varies anywhere from $6 to $10. They get between $6 to $10 from every dollar we donate. So they do amazing things with a buck. It's just one buck gives them 7 meals, 8 meals. I don't know. It must be the miracle of the loaves or something. I've read about these over and over and over again. How they do this is just amazing.
Yes, it is. It is. So how'd you get this idea? Where'd you come up with the idea to do this?
Well, you know, that is a long, long story. But, you know, I have been in wines all my life, so that was kind of an easy transition. My goal was at age 65, finally, to do something to give back. That was when it was about maybe 58 or something. And, you know, one day you see people all of a sudden around you dropping dead, you know, and all these kind of things. And then
that can be a wake-up call.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. You know, we get different calls here and there. And so I got to think and say, you know, God forbid, one day I die and I got all these wonderful plants in my pocket and God is going to ask you, you know, what did you do? And all you got to show for is a piece of paper. So I kind of... got a little more urgency, and the homeless thing always kind of has been on my mind. Different images of seeing homeless people sleeping in cardboard boxes. I had never seen that till I came over here, and that kind of stuck in my mind. And just about at the same time as I was thinking how we're going to do this thing and what we're going to raise funds for, there was a report on the news channel documentary about this star in the WNBA, you know, how she had become a star, and it showed that her mother was a beautician and became allergic to the chemicals, and she lost her job, and they lived in the car for a year, and all they needed was a rent, 1 month's rent. Yeah. And it kind of shocked me, and all this kind of, you know, came together at one thing. And prevention, of course, as we all know, the old saying, one stitch in time, saves nine, is a good thing. You know, help the people before they become homeless. So.
Well, listen, Anton, thank you so much, and I hope that what you have done in telling your story to our listeners inspires somebody out there to do something in their own worlds that can address this issue. Because as you say, you know, it is not one of the proudest parts of the United States that in so many of our urban areas, we do have thousands of individuals who call the streets their homes. And, you know, you're doing your part, and the rest of us have to kind of step up and do our part to try to make sure that our brothers and sisters who are on the street, that we can help them get off the street and prevent others from going there. So I just want to thank you so much, Anton, for taking the time to be with us. And if people want to find out more about Wines for Humanity, is there a website they can go to?
Absolutely, and thank you for asking. It is simply Wines for Humanity. And, you know, we do have a vehicle here. We are in 9 states, quickly from Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Missouri, Florida, California, Arizona, Colorado. And if for all the people out there that want to make a difference, they have an opportunity right here to put their stamp on this lovely planet here, and knowing and feeling that they made a difference, that they reached out to some of their neighbors. It is a fun thing to do. It's a good thing. The hosts love what we do. And on top of that, our people here even get paid for it. So why not join us and continue helping us with this a vision that one day we can put a stamp on the elimination of homelessness.
Anton Steinhardt, founder and president of Wines for Humanity, thank you for being with us. Thank you for joining us on Just Love. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.